At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
In October of 1979, FBI agents broke into the Shorecrest Hotel, which was owned by Frank Ballastieri's son, Joe. They wanted to put microphones inside Snug's, the restaurant where Frank Ballastieri made a lot of his deals, and in his younger son, John's office. Retired FBI agent Gary Magnuson told me that before they planted the recording devices, they studied the blueprints for the building.
There was only one door into his office, and there was a hallway that ran there between the check-in desk and his office. So we were trying to figure out how in the world are we going to be able to get a microphone into his office. We can't go through that door. We'd be spotted immediately.
Gary turned to Rick Prokop, an FBI tech agent. Prokop had been trained in the installation of microphones and other listening devices. He told Gary his plan.
So we got back together. He says, what we're going to do, we have to get into the basement below the first floor. And I'm going to drill up through 18 inches of concrete into the floor of the office and insert a microphone under the carpet. I just looked at him, really. He says, yeah, we can do it, but we got to get in there. So then we contacted FBI headquarters, and there was a guy that was the renowned lock expert. He could pick any lock ever made. So I got a hold of him, and I told him the circumstances. He says, oh, yeah, no problem. I'll come out and do it.
They ultimately did come up with a cloak and dagger way to get into the building, and it sounded like something out of a movie, but it really happened. From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is My Cousin Augie. I'm Mary Spicuzza. Episode 7, The Downfall of Mr. B. The first thing the FBI had to do was break into the Shorecrest. Gary asked the lock expert how to do that.
The front door to the Shorecrest was always locked after a certain time of night. And so we had to get in to the building, down the basement, so we could insert that microphone. So he says, get me a female agent, and we will pull up in a van, and we'll act like we're drunk, and snuggle and so on in front of the Shorecrest, lean up against the building and so on, and I will make a key to the front door. This was a big deal. We had the surveillance team out on John and Joe and Frank to make sure they didn't come back at the time. We did it in the dead of night when it was very quiet. The special agent in charge was out on the street, which is unusual. And that was because if any of us had been stopped by the police, he would intervene. Now, we didn't let the police in on this because we had heard that they had a policeman that was providing information to them. So we didn't dare let the police know what we were doing. So we used codes in our radio communications.
On that first night, they made the key.
So after a number of tries, the lock expert, they have a key that they fit, and it makes the marks on the inside of the lock and so on. Then he'd go into the van and he'd file it and fix it. And it took about three or four attempts. Finally, he got the key.
The next night, they went back to install the microphones.
We didn't want to go through one of the back doors because we were sure they would be checking that closer. So we were right out there on the street. So we went downstairs, we get in there, and Rick Prokop had done measurements on the blueprint to the distance from the door that we had to drill up to get into the office. So we measured, we got where we thought we were in the right position, and he brought out his drill. It had a long extension on it because we knew the floor was 18 inches thick, and he started drilling. And the cement dust was coming down. He was covered in it, his head. Started laughing. Finally, he got it done. He inserted the microphone, packed it so it stayed in place.
But that night, there was no way to check if it was working.
So that first day, we were really excited. Turned on the microphone. Nothing. No sound of him, you know, moving around in his office or anything else. Then we heard footsteps, and we looked at each other. What the heck now? Found out we had come up short, and we were in the hallway. So we had to go back in and drill again.
Yes, really. They had to sneak in a second time to move the microphone.
And this time he was successful, and so the microphone was placed right under the carpeting, and the quality was quite good. So from then on, we started getting some real good conversations, and turned out to be an absolute key to the whole case.
In addition to bugging the Shorecrest, the FBI put microphones in another restaurant owned by the Ballesteris, which was called Leonardo's. The assistant special agent in charge, Mike DeMarco, was involved in placing that microphone. Mary Zahn and Bill Janz wrote about the FBI's efforts in their 1988 series for the Milwaukee Sentinel, called the Ballesteri Tapes. Here's Mary reading an excerpt.
At Leonardo's, agents were getting ready to leave when the female agent saw a big rat on the bar, DeMarco said. The rat was chewing on cherries you put in cocktails. The woman shrieked, the rat jumped and knocked four glasses off the bar. Our nerves shattered like the glasses, DeMarco said.
As you'll recall from episode 3, when the FBI first wiretapped Frank Ballesteri back in the mid-60s, they did it illegally and almost derailed the tax fraud case against him in the process. But this time, it was legal. That's because Congress decided that if the feds were ever going to take down organized crime, they needed more tools. They passed a sweeping crime bill, which took effect in 1970. It made secret wiretaps legal if they were approved by a judge. It got a little tricky, though, because they were only allowed to record conversations that were relevant to the investigation. Former federal prosecutor John Franke explained it to me.
When you get a wiretap authorization, you have it to look for evidence of certain crimes, and you have to turn it off, minimize it, if you're not hearing evidence of that crime. So the tape would go on, you'd listen to people talking, they could be talking about, you know, Christmas dinner, Thanksgiving, or the Feast of San Gennaro in New York or some event, and the FBI agent, he had to be fairly well trained in order to identify, particularly the way the Ballesteris would speak on these tapes. You had to be pretty attuned to what was going on to try to recognize, are they talking about something relevant to the warrant or not? And of course, when you're taping someone's office or that booth at Leonardo's or a wiretapping a phone, you know, most of the time it's not going to be relevant. And so your obligation was to turn it off.
The effort of listening to all of the recordings was a massive undertaking.
I think the list of agents who actually sat and monitored the wiretap was close to 100.
Franke told me he learned a lot from the agents who listened to the tapes.
So they, you know, they schooled me in a lot of organized crime history just to kind of get a sense for the background and how things worked and the protocols you really need to understand to make sense out of what often seemed like silliness. And in listening to them, you often had to listen to them several times before you could really get a sense for what was being said.
The wiretaps provided a lot of information about Ballastieri's operations in Milwaukee and elsewhere, including his ties to the skimming of Las Vegas casinos, which we covered in episode 3. Here's Gary Magnuson again.
As things developed, we got conversations over the phone and so on that indicated that he was doing all kinds of various things. And he mentioned one time, he said, "It's almost time for my transfusion." Now, what in the world was he talking about? He's not sick, he hasn't been to the doctor, hasn't been to the hospital or anything. What transfusion? Well, we learned later that that was money that had been skimmed out of the Las Vegas casinos.
We'll have more after the break.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
In late 1979, FBI agents moved in. They served subpoenas to several people close to Ballastieri, including his brother Peter.
An interesting story. Another agent served by the name of Fred Thorne. He served a subpoena on Peter Ballastieri. And he went up to the front porch, rang the doorbell. Peter Ballastieri came to the door but didn't open the door. "What do you want?" And Fred said, "I got a subpoena for you." He said, "I'm not taking no subpoena." So Fred slipped it through the mail slot in the door like a lot of those older homes had. Well, Peter Ballastieri had a dog, and the dog grabbed the subpoena and ripped it to shreds. But he had still been served. So Fred said, "You and your dog have been served, Peter."
In March 1980, the FBI raided a number of Ballastieri's properties, including his home. He wouldn't answer the door, so they had to use a sledgehammer to get in. Back at the Shorecrest, the FBI made an interesting discovery in the office.
One of our agents found a wall safe hidden behind a photograph on the wall. So we called the locksmith, and he came up and drilled the safe. In that safe was $200,000 in cash in $100 bills.
FBI agents later caught the Ballastieri's on tape, trying to come up with a legal explanation for where all that money came from.
And Frank proposed, well, let's say we got it, I think he had a daughter named Catherine, or so, I don't remember, but he'll say, well, we got it for her wedding. It was her wedding, you know, where they give the money and stuff when they money dance or whatever they do and stuff like that. And then John speaks up and says, no, they'll never buy that. You'd never get $200,000 in a situation like that. What we'll do, we'll claim it was earnings by Joe. So now they're participating in the covering up of ill-gotten gains.
FBI transcripts also have Frank Ballastieri complaining about the agents that were to be posted in the office overnight as security. He was heard asking his sons, "What's the remedy now? Do I get a couple guys to shoot him down or what?" To which his son Joe replied, "You can't even slap a federal agent, much less shoot him down." Clearly, Frank didn't know that the agents were listening to his every word. One of the most chilling conversations investigators heard involved a simple list. The FBI needed a handwriting sample from a Balistrieri bookmaker to help bolster their gambling case. He asked what he should write, and they gave him a list of names. It included victims of unsolved murders. The Balistrieris found out and were talking about it in the office at the Shorecrest. John Franke was haunted by the conversation, and I was too when he told me about it.
Anthony Biernat in 63, Augie Maniacci, Louis Fazio, August Palmisano, and then Vince Maniacci, the attempt murder. They list the names, and then one of them laughs, says, "What is that, the hit list?" And they all laugh. Referring to dead people as the hit list and laughing. Is that enough to convict you?
As a result of the FBI investigation, Frank Balistrieri was charged with conspiracy to violate federal gambling laws, as well as other gambling and tax charges. He and his sons were also charged with extortion. The gambling and extortion cases were tried separately. The wiretaps were key to making the case. So was the undercover operation with agents Joe Pistone and Ty Cobb, who were using the names Donnie Brasco and Tony Conti.
The wiretap telephone lines had produced the clear evidence of bookmaking. It was just no question about that. That was airtight. But Frank wasn't involved in any of those. The most important people weren't. So we had to piece Frank into it by connecting him through statements he made to other undercover operations, including wanting Joe Pistone to take it over. That was a clue that maybe Frank had something to do with it if he asked him to run his gambling operation for him. And then there were other wiretap conversations that Frank clearly is aware of the gambling.
Frankie also remembers the steps required just to meet with Joe Pistone and Ty Cobb as they were preparing for trial. That's because there was a $500,000 contract out on Pistone's life due to his work infiltrating the mafia.
The FBI said, "Okay, you got to spend some time getting ready for trial with these guys, and you're not going to know where you're going." You know, they would tell me sort of roughly what climate to pack for, but I would not know till I went to the airport where we were going.
But all of that effort was worth it. Frankie told me Pistone became the star witness.
He just oozed credibility in front of the jury. I think the jury just ate up whatever Joe Pistone told them.
Balistrieri's lawyer, Albert Krieger, had Joe Pistone on the stand for hours. Pistone told me at one point he started to lose his voice.
And it was, I guess, late into the afternoon, and my voice was going, and I didn't have any water at the by my witness stand. So Krieger saw that, you know, that I needed a drink. So he poured a glass of water from his table, from the defense table, and brings it to me. So I take the glass and I look at it and I say, "Mr. Krieger, you take a sip first." So he did. He took a sip, and I said, "Okay, now I'll have a drink." And it backed up the jury. Everybody got... Even the judge laughed.
I asked him what it was like to testify against Frank Balistrieri.
Frank, you know, he was cool as a cucumber, sitting there. You know, I had no feelings one way or another for the defendants.
But he definitely had some opinions.
They were doing what they were doing. They did. They were gangsters, thieves before they met me. They were thieves, gangsters during the time I was dealing with them. And if they went to jail and got out of jail, they were going to be thieves and gangsters after. There was no rehabilitation for these type of individuals.
John Franke told me the undercover agent's testimony was crucial to proving the extortion charge against Balistrieri.
The jury had to find that Frank had threatened Conti, which really only happened once and was not on tape.
That meant Ty Cobb needed to testify about their first meeting when Balistrieri thought he was a government agent. Here's an excerpt from a newspaper account about what he said on the stand in March 1984.
In testimony Thursday, Cobb said that a July 29, 1978 meeting at Snug's restaurant began with Balistrieri refusing to shake Cobb's hand. Cobb said Balistrieri had recoiled at his hand while being introduced to Cobb and had informed the agent that Milwaukee's vending machine business belonged to Balistrieri. In testimony Thursday, Cobb said of Balistrieri, he said, "How dare you come into my town?" He told me that, "We've been looking for you all week. We thought you were the G. We were going to hit you." Cobb said in court that his hands were shaking after the meeting. "I was upset. I was scared," he said.
He also testified about the deal they agreed to.
Cobb testified that after he signed an agreement August 23, 1978, giving Joseph and John Balistrieri the right to buy half his business for $5,000, Joseph Balistrieri said, "We're going to take over the whole damn city." The Balistrieris got a receipt showing they had paid $500 for the option agreement, but they actually paid nothing, Cobb testified.
Balistrieri didn't seem too concerned about people ratting on him either.
Cobb said Balistrieri boasted that informants did not worry him. Frank said, "No one lived to take the witness stand against me."
Something else he overheard hinted at Frank's penchant for killing.
Balistrieri would like to have his own crematorium and cemetery. That would take care of a lot of his problems.
Cobb's testimony marked the first time anyone said publicly that Frank had been gloating about my cousin's murder.
During the conversation at Snug's, according to Cobb, Balistrieri made allusions to the bombing death of August Pomazzano in 1978. Cobb said that one of the Rockford men asked Balistrieri what happened to Pomazzano, a convicted gambler. "He was arrogant to my face," Balistrieri said. "So now they can't find his skin."
Frank Balistrieri was found guilty of conspiracy to direct an illegal gambling business, failure to file taxes, and extortion. He was sentenced to 13 years in prison, while his sons each got 8 years in the extortion case. Even though Balistrieri was never charged in the murder of my cousin Augie, or anybody else's murder for that matter, the prosecution was able to bring it up at sentencing.
We never prosecuted, but we used them throughout, and really we asked the court to sentence him for the murders, and it's a part of the background, even though he wasn't convicted of. A judge can consider all sorts of bad character stuff. And if nothing else, is someone who had taken credit for the murders and had, you know, in a common sense way, indicated some level of involvement in them.
After being convicted here in Milwaukee, Frank and his sons went on trial in Kansas City for their role in the massive Las Vegas casino skimming case. Frank pled guilty to one count of conspiracy and one count of racketeering. He received 10 years in prison, to be served at the same time as his 13-year sentence in Milwaukee. His sons were acquitted. More after the break.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
In their 1988 series, The Balistrieri Tapes, reporters Mary Zahn and Bill Janz wrote about what prison was like for Frank Balistrieri. Zahn read an excerpt for us.
"Far from power and prestige, his todays aren't like his yesterdays. He used to have hundreds of thousands of dollars lying around. Now, he rooms with another man. Working and playing all night, he used to sleep into the afternoon. Now, he is required to get up at 6 a.m. Commanding respect, he lived a life filled with people he ordered around. Now he is told when he can eat and when he can sleep. Not long ago, threats could be made, and money could be skimmed, and murders could be discussed, and crime was his business. Now, he wears surplus military clothing. Milwaukee's most famous gangster is federal prisoner number 0188-045. At the age of 70, Frank Peter Balistrieri mops floors.
Frank Balistrieri was released early from prison in 1991 due to his failing health. He died February 7, 1993, at the age of 74.
In a letter to a judge in 1987, Balistrieri wrote, "I have one consolation. Hell cannot be any worse for me, but I will never know. For when I am judged by the judge of judges, the worst sentence I can get is purgatory."
Frank Balistrieri was never charged with my cousin's murder. You might be wondering why we have not heard the Balistrieri side of the story. Frank's oldest son, Joe, died in 2010. I did reach out to his other son, John, in August of 2023. He made it clear that he did not want to talk. There is a part of me that still wonders what he might have said, but we will never know. John passed away in June of 2024. Nick Montos was never charged with killing Augie either. He spent years as a fugitive for various crimes. I talked with Gary Magnuson about how justice finally caught up with Montos in 1995, when he was 78 years old.
The last crime he committed was a store, I think, in Massachusetts or someplace. And the lady that ran the store beat the crap out of him because he was an old man at that time. And the police came and took him away, and he ended up dying in prison.
I was just reading about that and how he, I think it was a like little old Jewish lady, and he used an anti-Semitic slur, and she happened to have a baseball bat. And sounds like he had it coming.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Too bad it didn't happen earlier.
Magnuson told me Balistrieri's convictions marked the beginning of the end for the Mafia.
We had investigations going in Kansas City, in Chicago, in Las Vegas, and they all independent initially, but then they all came together because they were all tied together. And after our convictions in Milwaukee, there was a trial in Kansas City as well, where we convicted all of the bosses of the families. And I testified in that trial a couple of times. So it was a big deal. It was a big deal. And in Las Vegas, we cleaned the mob out as far as their control of anything out there. Completely annihilated them. Milwaukee, I don't think there's a family anymore that I'm aware of. Chicago still functions, but it's not the same. Not the same.
Pistone agrees that the Mafia today isn't anything like it used to be.
But back in their heyday, yeah, they were glorified. I mean, you couldn't go anywhere where if they knew that you were even associated with the Mafia, that you weren't treated with royalty, you know? And of course, you know, if you had an Italian last name, you were a member, you were, you know, had some association with the Mafia. I don't think it's so much anymore today because I'm proud to say that, you know, our case, you know, was the beginning of all the Mafia cases that brought to the downfall of them. They're not, I mean, you know, they're not as strong. I mean, they have nowhere near the strength today that they had back in the day. Today, they're just another criminal element, another criminal organization.
Author Gavin Schmidt is often asked about organized crime in Milwaukee today.
I'm always really clear and upfront with people when I get asked about, is there a Mafia in Milwaukee today? That's a question I get asked often. And I say, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. But asterisks. And the reason I say that is the way that I have to do my research is I'm reliant very heavily on news reports and on FBI files. Mm-hmm. If the news doesn't report on it, I don't generally know about it. And if the FBI didn't investigate it, I don't generally know about it. So publicly, I've seen no evidence. I've definitely seen that since Frank Belzdrey's passing, it's essentially vanished. You know, I hear rumors here and there that things are still going on, but as far as I can definitively say, it seems like it just, when Frank left, it just kind of left with him.
During the 3 years I spent on this project, I had a lot of doubts about whether or not I should investigate my cousin Augie's murder. Those doubts would often wake me up in the middle of the night.
It is about 2 a.m. on, August 19th, I guess? Yeah, and I am up again thinking about the story. I just finished, huge chunk of pages of FBI documents about my cousin, and I think I was a little taken aback by, I knew he was a gambler. I was a bit taken aback by the extent of his gambling and the extent of his, bookmaking operation at Palmy's. I think it was just kind of bigger than I realized. I still have a lot more to read. I feel like it's, never ending, but yeah, I'm just a little taken aback by the scope. All right, well, I'm going to try to get some more sleep, but talk soon. Bye.
Was I doing the right thing? Would my family stop speaking to me? What would my dad think of me digging up the stories he never wanted to talk about? I brought that up with E. Michael McCann, the retired district attorney.
I can see why it's a pain to you to try to find out the truth. What's the story? What is the story? And it's buried with the passage of years and the passage of secrecy. And, it's complex and it's difficult. You're really going, it's very interesting that you're doing this, and I can see why that bothers you.
Every time I started to think maybe it wasn't worth it, I would get a sign or a word of encouragement that Augie's story needed to be told. One of them came from Ted Engelbart, the retired bomb squad detective.
I tell you, I think your father would be very proud of you looking into this and putting it together. You're looking for the facts of here's what happened. I think that's great.
Thank you. That's very nice. I like your interpretation because I was thinking, God, I hope my dad isn't rolling over in his grave and ready to come kill me.
No. His daughter's a little inquisitive and she's going to get to the bottom of it. I think that's great.
Oh, thank you. That's really nice to hear.
The most important conversations I had were with Augie's son, Mike. He was reluctant at first, but my story, which published in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel in January of 2024, helped to change his mind.
I know at one point you said you feel like the truth has come out about who your dad was. What does that mean to you to have, the record set straight?
It's a relief because a lot of people through the years, people have actually come up to me and said, are you made? do you have your own family? Or I'm like, well, first of all, you're an idiot for saying something so stupid. But it's just how the people perceive these types of things. When they see a lot of this stuff when the movies come out, like The Sopranos or so on and so forth, they romanticize about it and they think that it's so cool or whatever. But I've been on the receiving end of it, falsely. And it's not that romantic. It is... it's a relief for me that the truth has come out. Various people who, through the years, have asked me questions and everything, and I've told them the truth, they're now like, Mike, you were right. And I said, well, I wasn't saying, the lies or sensationalism to impress you or this or that. I just said the truth, whether you wanted to hear it or not, or believe it or not. People will want to believe what they want to believe.
Well, I'm sorry you didn't get more time with him. That I can't imagine going through that when you're 15 and then the way he died and the media and everything. So I'm sorry that you didn't get another 15 or 45 years or
Well, when those responsible meet their judge, may God have mercy, because I won't.
even though I didn't actually catch the killer or get to confront those responsible for my cousin's murder, in the end, that didn't turn out to be the point. I ended up with so much more. This project helped my family finally talk about Cousin Augie after more than four decades of silence. Through those conversations, I came to a better understanding of who he really was. August Palmisano wasn't just some guy blown up in a parking garage. He was a father, business owner, and beloved member of the community. And to me, he was family.
Somebody asked me what I hope, like, kind of hope my family's reaction was, and I said that I hope, you know, my parents and your dad are up in heaven kind of like toasting and smiling and feeling like a little bit more at peace after all of this.
I would think so. You know, if they were here, let's just say they're here in spirit, they'd be grinning and at peace.
My Cousin Augie is written and produced by me, Mary Spacuzza. Executive producers are Bill Schultz and Gina Barton. Our editor is Daphne Chen. Sound engineer is Bill Schultz. Andrea Brunty is our graphic designer. Executive editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is Greg Borowski. I also want to thank Tom Ketting, Carrie Spivak, Burford Gammon, Chris Ramirez, Sarah Volpenheim, Ricardo Torres, Frankie Simmons and Dan Simmons for their help with this podcast. For more stories about Donnie Brasco, listen to the Deep Cover podcast with Joe Pistone and Leo Rossi, or pick up Joe's book, Donnie Brasco, My Undercover Life in the Mafia. If you are interested in more stories about the FBI's investigation into organized crime in Milwaukee and Las Vegas, you can check out Gary Magnuson's book, Straw Men. For more information about the Milwaukee Mafia, listen to Gavin Schmidt's podcast or pick up one of his books. My stories about Cousin Augie, along with photos, can be found on our website at jsonline.com/mycousinaugie.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.